But we'll come a little bit closer. Tonight, we're continuing on. We're going to kill two birds with one stone tonight. We're going to kill two birds with 12 stones tonight. Tonight, we're going to be looking at the tabernacle and why it's significant, because just to let you know, as we mentioned last time we looked at that little episode of the golden calf in between. Is that correct? We looked at that. And it fits between the giving of the command to make the tabernacle and the actual making of the tabernacle. So with that in mind, we're going to try to get both of those things done tonight. So let's pray. Father in heaven, for Jesus' sake, come into this place, into this time, and may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our God, our rock, and our redeemer. And all God's saints said, amen. Why the tabernacle, and why go to such detail in describing the tabernacle? And it's incredible detail. I mean, as I said, it's excruciating detail, particularly the second half of the description of actually being made. The detail is downright painful. Why do that? Any ideas why there's such detail? Let me give you a hint. Discipline, well, possibly.
Obedience.
Yeah. They didn't do so good at that already. This. Chilton's. This is a Chilton's manual. This is a Chilton's manual. Chilton's manuals are old, and anybody that's ever worked on cars knows what a Chilton's manual tells you how to do. It tells you how to fix a car. This one tells you how to fix a truck and van service manual. I don't know the dates on here because this thing is so gross and awful, and then I'm touching it near my holy yellow sweater. But this tells you how to fix a truck or a van, or the Chilton's manuals would tell you how to fix cars. This has not been used in a very, 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 very long time, this particular one. This was procured for me today by a member of the congregation, and he went back to his shop and asked the shop foreman where this was, and he said, well, it's in the back there, but what do you want that for? Everything's on computer. Which everything is on computer. But the idea is this, is that I don't know if you know this or not, but your car breaks down, okay? Your car needs tires. Your car needs shock absorbers, or actually, pardon me, struts. They don't have shock absorbers anymore. They have McPherson struts in the front there. It wears out, and stuff that wears out needs to be replaced. And you don't just replace it willy-nilly. You replace the stuff as it was designed to be replaced. Because you go around replacing things willy-nilly, particularly on cars. Well, back in the day, back when I actually worked on cars, you could replace things willy-nilly because the tolerances were not all that great. As I said, they're all manner of things that you could set a set of points on a Ford 302 using a dime, for crying out loud. The thickness of a dime. Now, that's not a precise measurement, using the thickness of a dime. But one could do it if you knew how to just fudge it just a little bit. Nowadays, let's just say there's a little bit more precision that's involved in fixing these things. But so here's the manual on how to fix things. If you're going to make a tent and the stuff that goes with it, do you know what's going to happen over time? It's going to wear out. It's going to wear out, particularly over not a 10-year period or a 20-year period, but over a 100-year period or a 200-year period or a 300-year period or a 400-year period, stuff wears out. You know, while it's a holy place, it's not made out of, you know, unobtainium. That's a little NASCAR joke there, unobtainium. That's what they make the tubes out of and so forth. But it's not made out of that. It's not made out of some magic stuff. It's made out of real stuff. Just like the communion that we use, it's not magic wine. It's not magic bread. It won't keep forever and ever, amen. We need new wine. We need new bread. I mean, anybody that's ever done the sacristy back there knows that it's just regular stuff. The water that we put in the baptismal font is just water. It'll get stagnant if you don't watch out. You got to maintain it. And the tabernacle is the same way. So what we have before us is a bit of a Chilton's manual on the tabernacle. How to design it, what goes into it, what materials are going to be in. But not only that, there's also, stick with me, because there's some important things for us living today. Because you might say to yourself, what possible importance might it have for us? But I think as we get to the end, we'll do that and we'll take a look at that. Now, just to kind of give you a quick overview, the preparation of the tabernacle. First of all, there are contributions that will be involved. There are various furnishings that we get to look at. There's the tabernacle itself proper. There is the priestly raiment, that's the clothes, the duds that the high priest gets to wear. And then there are the consumables. And last but not least, the craftsmen. And also we want to take a look at the purpose. So these are the things that we're going to be looking at tonight. Why are, what are the contributions? You think capital campaigns are new, huh? No, they're not. This one's going to be an interesting... This is the most unbelievable capital campaign you've ever been a part of, this one that's coming up. I mean, in here, not the one that's coming up here, but the one that's coming up in here is quite an interesting campaign. So those are some of the things that we're going to be looking at with regard to the tabernacle. Let me first again give you a definition of the tabernacle. The material that we're going to be looking at is from Exodus chapter 25 to Exodus chapter 31. And then it picks up again at Exodus chapter 35 through Exodus chapter 40, okay? So the first part is God telling Moses what it's supposed to look like. The second part is the actual manufacturing of the tabernacle. And as I said before, I'll mention it again, tabernacle, in our mind, we think Mormon tabernacle, we're thinking a big stone building. That is a gross misuse of the word tabernacle. A tabernacle is simply a tent. This one happens to be a fancier tent than most, but it's a tent. And again, in terms of the scope of size, we have to recognize that it's not as big as you think it is. Sometimes we think tabernacle, we think huge. This isn't a very big thing. I mean, it's big enough. The actual tabernacle itself probably would go from there to there. And one of the things that I once served a church, and again, with probably the most unusual name of any Lutheran church ever, St. Mary Magdalene Lutheran Church. I mean, you know, St. Mary Lutheran Church would have been a tough enough handle. But to throw Magdalene in there, particularly when Dan Brown's novels are coming out, boy, I tell you, we became the hot place because people wanted to know about what about a church named St. Mary Magdalene? Of course, you've got these Dan Brown down... It's an easy name. Daniel's not a hard name. Brown's not a hard name to say. Why am I struggling with it? Dan Brown's, you know, the Da Vinci Code, when that came out, you know, Mary Magdalene was this kind of this central figure of this, and so we had to deal with all that nonsense. Well, anyway, the carpet in St. Mary Magdalene Lutheran Church in Savage, Minnesota, the carpet matched the layout of the tabernacle. We had a pink and non-pink. There was a pink carpet, and there was kind of a maroon carpet like this, and it was just those two colors. But how it was, there was a back part that was maroon, and that was sort of the court of the Gentiles. And then there was the main part here, which was pink, and that was the tabernacle court, so that where anybody could go that was supposed to be able to go. But then up front, it was back maroon again. We had a little wooden... risers that were covered in the maroon carpet. There were little sectional pieces, little squares that we could move around and build up, and they were like the Holy of Holies. And then there was the altar right on top of that. So it was easy to teach about this there, but we're not there. So we have to talk about it in another way. Okay, so moving along, we have the contributions. Let's talk about that. And Now, just to let you know, we're going to bounce around. And the reason why we're going to bounce around is because it's not linear. The description of this kind of goes back and forth, and I wanted to get categories in so you could get a better idea rather than just a linear straight-through read of this. The first thing that we read about is the initial contributions. God says there's going to be needing some stuff. And here's the stuff that we need. We need, in Exodus chapter 25, verses 1 through 9, in Exodus 25, 1 through 9, it talks about the stuff that's the... Keith, do you have that there? Just, you do. Would you mind reading the Exodus 29, 1 through... 25, 1 through 9.
The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the people of Israel that they take for me a contribution. Mm-hmm. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall receive the contribution for me."
Now notice what it says there. Every man whose heart moves him. Not every man, but only those whose heart is moved to do this. This is not a requirement, okay? This is not a requirement. Read on.
"And this is the contribution that you shall receive from them. Gold,
silver,
and bronze."
Bronze. Sounds like the Olympics, doesn't it?
"Blue and purple and scarlet yarns."
And I like in the old, it said blue and purple and scarlet stuffs. But yes, yarns, yeah, okay.
"And fine twine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins."
Tanned ram skins.
Goat skins. Acacia wood. Oil for the lamps. Spices for the anointing oil. And for the fragrances. Onyx stones and stones for setting.
Okay.
"For the ephod and for the breastplate."
Yep.
"And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst, exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and of all its furniture, so you shall make it."
Okay. Again, a couple things here. "Exactly as I show you." Okay, just the way, as I said, don't deviate from the manual. I want it to look like this, and here's the stuff that you're going to need. So here's your parts list, and I'm going to give you the instructions as well. So it's all going to be there. But this is quite a parts list. I mean, let's just be honest. This is quite a parts list. But there's also something else there that it said. "For the purpose of dwell, that I might dwell in your midst." That's a key thing. We're going to come back to that. Don't forget that. That he pretty much says that right away, that I might dwell in your midst. Okay, the next part is Exodus chapter 35, verses 4 through 29. Now, I want to read this part now. So this is now the actual part where they're going out to get the stuff. Now, I want us to read this because there's something in here that's the most incredible, the most unbelievable thing you'll ever read in the Bible. The most unbelievable thing you'll ever read in the Bible is right here. And no, it's not the parting of the Red Sea. No, it's not Jesus raising the dead. This is far more unbelievable than any of that. Okay? Read on. 35, 4 through 29.
4 through 29.
4 through 29.
Moses said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. Take from among you a contribution to the Lord. Whoever is of a generous heart,
okay,
let him bring the Lord's contribution."
All right, see there again, it's only of a generous heart. You're not trying to coerce anybody.
"Gold, silver, and bronze."
There it is again.
"Blue and purple and scarlet yarns and fine twined linens."
Yep.
"Goat's hair, tanned ram skins and goat's skins, acacia wood, oil for lights, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and stones for setting, and an ephod for the breastplate. Let every skillful craftsman among you come and make all that the Lord has commanded: the tabernacle, its tents, its coverings, its hooks, its frames, its bars, its pillars, and its bases, the ark with its poles, the mercy seat, and the veil of the screen, the table with its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of the presence."
All right, so you get the thing. Here's all the stuff. It's being made the way it's supposed to be. So we're now we're getting into a greater detail. Now let's skip to 36, verses 2 through 7. See what it's got to say there. So the people are getting busy to start doing this. So let's see what it says in 36, verses 2 through 7.
"And Moses called
Sorry.
Beziel?
Mm-hmm.
And
Oholiab.
And every craftsman in whose mind the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart had stirred him up to come and do the work. And they received from Moses all the contribution that the people of Israel had brought for doing the work on the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him freewill offerings every morning.
So they got enough. They keep bringing stuff in. Keep going.
So that all the craftsmen who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the task that he was doing, and said to Moses, the people bring much more
than... Now, the church board will never say this to you. Just want you to know. Read.
The people bring much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do. So Moses gave command, and word was proclaimed throughout the camp, let no man or woman do anything more for the contribution of the sanctuary.
Stop giving. You're giving too much. Stop giving right now. Stop this minute. Didn't I not tell you this would be the most unbelievable thing that you've ever heard? I mean, sure, Moses can part the Red Sea. Sure, Jesus can raise it. But can somebody actually get up there and say, stop giving, stop giving, stop giving? Now, isn't that kind of funny? I just think that's just amusing. It blesses my heart. Every time I come across this passage, I am amused. But that shows you the level to which these people were giving towards the building of this sanctuary. They were showing an immense amount of gratitude. I think it's pretty cool. Okay, so we have the initial contributions, and that's what this is. And guess what? Like any building program or anything of the kind, you got to get the stuff to build the stuff. I mean, you're going to need beams, and you're going to need drywall, and you're going to need electrical, and you're going to need plumbing, and you're going to need all that stuff. And there's stuff that you need, right? That's initial, okay? But, Rob, does carpet wear out? It does, as I said. I'm sure you're happy that it does. Absolutely. I'm sure that you're happy for initial installations, but you're probably happier that it does wear out and that you need more stuff put in, right? Because guess what? You need to maintain the stuff that you've already got. Now, this is all making sense, isn't it? As I said, I just want you to understand this all makes sense. So there is another offering that, there's another place for, we don't need to go through there about. The fact is that three times it mentions the fact that there are initial contributions. But there are also what's called the half shekel tax. In addition to the building of the taking the contributions for the initial offering, there is a thing called the half shekel tax. Now, this half shekel tax, by the way, if you're curious to see how much stuff comes in, chapter 38, verses 21 through 24 and 27 through 31, that will tell you how much stuff comes in. And I'll let you figure out how much money that's worth today. It's a lot of money, because you're talking about an immense amount of gold. A talent was about 100 pounds. So it's 8 talents of gold, something like that. And, you know, lots of talents of silver, about 1,700 talents of silver. This is a lot of money. A lot of money. A lot of precious metals going into this. So in any case, but the half shekel tax is something a little bit different. Pick it up with Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 through 18.
The Lord said to Moses, when you take the census of the people of Israel,
yep,
then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there will be no plague among them when you number them. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel,
yep,
according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs.
Yeah.
Well, that clears it up.
20 gerahs, of course.
Half a shekel as an offering to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward.
By the way, the footnotes tell you how much it is, so all that sort of stuff. Okay, read on.
Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering. The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less than the half a shekel when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for your lives. You shall take the atonement money from the people of Israel and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may bring the people of Israel to remembrance before the Lord, so as to make atonement for your lives.
Okay, making atonement, bringing to remembrance, those are two key things to remember. But this is the maintenance budget. This is the maintenance budget. And it's every year, every male over 20 gives one half of a shekel of silver for the temple tax. Flat rate tax, okay? No, and it tells you what it is. And it doesn't vary with inflation. It's just, here's what it is. It's a half a shekel of silver once a year if you're 20 years old. This is very simple. We don't have to fill out forms. You don't have to fill out different schedules. You know, there's not a half shekel of 1040 or a half shekel 1040A or a half shekel 1040EZ. There's none of that. It's just a half shekel. This makes sense, okay?
And they didn't have protesters.
And they, I'm not saying they didn't have protesters, because in fact, let's turn to Matthew chapter 17 and find out to see if they had protesters, tax protesters. Because this is fascinating. Just to give you some idea of context, Matthew 17 is taking place about 1,500 years later. 1,500 years later, okay? So we got that in perspective. All right, read.
When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the two drachma tax.
That would be a half shekel for those of you who don't know the difference between Greek conversion and Hebrew conversion, just for those that are there. That's a half shekel. Now, who came there? Who was it that came?
The collectors.
The collectors. Apparently, this was not given so willingly. Apparently, even though this was simple, apparently we had to send people out to collect this stuff. Okay, read on.
The collectors of the two drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?"
Yeah, they wanted to test Jesus out to see if he was a kosher guy.
He said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From who do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and yourself."
Me and you. Now, this is a case where it's good to be Jesus, wouldn't you say? You know, as I said, all you got to do is cast the hook in and you're going to get a fish with a whole shekel. And you and a good friend will have the half shekel tax paid for you. But I wanted you to see that this didn't go away. That when the tabernacle went away, this became a function of the temple. This was called the temple tax, and still you had to pay it, and every Jew over 20 years old that was male had to pay the temple tax. So this was kind of an interesting little thing that showed that it's still there. So there are the contributions. So there is, again, there's stuff to make it, and there's stuff to keep it going. Now, I'm not trying to point out the obvious, but, you know, in any kind of endeavor, particularly the endeavor that we have, stuff like this happens, and so I just want to show you. There it is in the Bible happening like that. Stuff to build it, and then stuff to make it. But, I mean, the stuff to build it was pretty nice stuff, just to let you know that. Now, the various furnishings. There are lots of different furnishings in this. The most significant... Yes, you may, Bob.
Where did the money come from? These people had all the money that they had within themselves.
Yes. Yeah, where did the money come from? This is a great question. We will recall that much of the money came from the Egyptians. You will recall that the Egyptians were despoiled, so to speak. They were ready to get rid of them, and so they said, "Come on, show us some love," when they left. And as a matter of fact, God instructed to say for the children of Israel to say to the Egyptians, "Come on, show us some love." And they did, showed them a lot of love, and they gave them a lot of stuff. Now, we have this image of the children of Israel acting as an isolated group that's on the surface of the moon, and there's no other human contact. Well, that's not true. There's nothing in the text that says that. Matter of fact, to the contrary, early on in Exodus 17, we already read that the Amalekites have showed up. Now, one thing I know about people is they like making money. All people like making money. It's kind of the thing that we do. And if we've got some excess, let's just say, goat hair to sell, we're going to sell excess goat hair, wouldn't you say? Because that's what they got no shortage of. They got no shortage of goats. Now, when we think of goat hair, we think goat hair, yish. When I think of goat hair, you know what I think of? Cashmere. Because that's what it's made out of. I mean, probably one of the finest fabrics on the planet. My nice possession, I have to brag on this. When I was in Korea, they have a place called Itaewon. Itaewon is a shopping district that's loaded with tailors. And they make custom-made suits there for practically nothing. You could get a tailor-made suit out of worsted wool for $100. I mean, just nothing. I mean, this suit probably cost you $2,000 in the United States. Well, I went to one. I ordered myself a suit like this, but I also saw that he had an overcoat, knowing that I was probably going to one day come back to the warmth of Minnesota when I was there. And so I had him make me a cashmere overcoat for $200. I just thought, score. But cashmere is expensive nowadays. I mean, as I said, even then it was. But again, it's a highly desirable commodity. So where do they get the money from? I'm just guessing, Bob, but they probably just didn't let those goats get hairy and say, you know, we're just going to let them become hippie goats. You know, they probably shored them up and pretty good. And but in any case, they probably did. I don't know. They got sheep, too. They make wool out of stuff, sheep. I mean, don't they? Again, all y'all know about this stuff. I don't. I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C., where they don't do anything except make Xerox paper. they don't actually make the paper. They just Xerox it. In any case, so there you go. They make the next thing. Is that satisfactory, Bob? That's just a guess on my part, just to let you know. I'm not saying they were actually in the cashmere business, okay? I'm just saying that's a guess. They did have a lot of resources there.
The Jews are good business.
You know, that's been said before, yeah. But in any case, so now we're moving right along. The Ark of the Covenant. This is an important piece of furniture. We're going to take a look at this and what the purpose of this Ark of the Covenant. Just to let you know, the word ark means box. That's really what it means. It's just a box. Now, this isn't any old box. There's some specifications that go with the making of this box, which we won't go into, but it's a pretty fancy-looking box, and I'll show you a picture of this box in just a minute. But that's an important thing that they want to make, and this box holds the covenant. I got if any of you ever want to go into my office and see a really cool box, I've got a cool box. I have a box that a guy made for me in Seguin to hold a really old, and it's a really old Bible. And it's made out of pecan wood and mesquite that's indigenous to Seguin. And it's really cool, well-made, and this is a special box for holding this special book that they gave me as a gift. It was kind of a neat gift. But it's a great-looking box. Well, this was a really great-looking box. Far better-looking box than something made out of pecan wood and mesquite. Ever seen mesquite? It's kind of a scraggly little thing. I'm surprised he was able to get anything big enough to get any lumber out of the thing, for crying out loud. But anyway, this is a box, but this is holding a very special thing. It's holding their part of the covenant tablet. God's part, that is, not their part. And it's going to hold some other stuff in it, but it's the idea that this is a special box, and this box, let's try to imagine that we're at St. Mary Magdalene Lutheran Church, and this Kreshtine's not here, that I'm going to walk up to the altar that's right here. I'm sure you've all been there and all remember it. Just kidding. And right here is where the box is. It's in the Holy of Holies. It's in the special place, and that's kind of where God shows up in that special place. And when God shows up in that special place, he remembers this covenant, this relationship, this list of things that he has with God's people. Kind of interesting that that's the place where it should be. We'll get back to that. Okay, so that's the first piece of furniture that we encounter. It's then the next one is a thing for the table of the bread of presence. Now, we're doing a sermon series on God's presence, a little play on words, you know, presence at Christmas and God's presence actually being with us, a little play on words there. But so what's happening there is that this bread is special bread. Now, you will recall, I meant to put this up there, that Jesus makes mention of David snitching this bread when he was hungry. He was not supposed to, but I think it's in Mark chapter 2 where Jesus recalls David snitching this bread. It's special bread. It's only for the priests, and they got this very special, cool-looking table for it. It's there as well. So that's one other thing that they have there. The next thing that they have is a golden lampstand. How many have ever seen a Jewish menorah? You know, menorah? Hanukkah is famous for menorahs. Hanukkah is coming up. But this menorah is not like the Hanukkah menorah. The difference is this. A Hanukkah menorah has 9 candles, or one central candle and 8 other ones. This one has 6 and one central one. This is actually a big oil lamp. That's what it is. It's not a candle or a candelabra. It's a giant oil lamp. And that's how the Holy of Holies stays illuminated, through this giant oil lamp. There's some special olive oil that's going to be used for this stuff as well. Anyway, then there is a bronze altar. Okay, one of the things that you'll find that as we read on, a lot of this stuff is wood that's covered with gold, got gold plating all over top of it, but it's basically just wood. Now, an altar would have a hard time being made that way. Why do you suppose that is? Well, wear and tear for one thing. Suppose, what do you do on altars? You sacrifice things. Yeah, that's part of what you do. And then how do you sacrifice them? Kind of explain to me how you make the sacrifice. You kill the animal with a knife, typically a flint knife. And then what do? You let the blood run out. That makes the good gravy. You don't know how gravy is made? That is exactly, no, it's not powder that comes from your Schilling or McCormick bottle, you know. No. It's cooked blood, yes. Sorry. It is. That's how it's made. The meat drippings. What do you think meat drippings are? Yeah, well, there are oil and fats in there too. But in any case, but what do you do next, though? You burn it. Well, if you're going to burn something, number one, on gold, and number two, on wood, how effective do you think that's going to be? Well, first of all, gold has a very low melting point as far as metals go. You can smelt it pretty easily. It's not hard to do. It's got a pretty low melting point. The other problem is the wood catching on fire. But bronze, on the other hand, you've got a whole different deal there going, so that's what you've got going there. Now, you'll notice that up here on the screen, I have 2 sets of Bible verses. The first set of Bible verses has to do with the instruction to build it, and the second set of Bible verses has to do with the actual building of it, just to kind of let you know what's up there, okay? Next, there is the altar of incense. How many of you grew up on a farm? Anybody grew up on a farm? Oh, there's a lot of you. You understand. What do pig farmers say to outsiders when they sniff and they make a funny-looking face and complain about the smell? Smells like my... It's like you knew that. I knew you were going to say that. Smells like money. But it still smells pretty bad. I don't care where you're at. Hit pig stuff... smells bad. And guess what? If you're going to be slaughtering a bunch of animals, did I tell you that I finally got my first deer as a doe? I finally got my first deer, and I didn't have to use a firearm. I used a Ford. Yes, I used a Ford. Actually, I didn't technically. It was sort of a tag team effort. It was kind of a tag team effort. It was and I may have done something wrong here too, so I admit that I may have done something wrong. But I was going down 94, and there was a car on either side of me, and right where it gets 3 lanes, right by Miller Chevrolet, you know where I'm talking about. All of a sudden, somebody in the left lane, the right lane, hits this deer and knocks it in my lane. It's dead, but I don't hit it, it goes underneath my car. and I go, and I'm just all, you know, 75 miles an hour. You kind of, it gets your attention. It's at night, and, you know, so you kind of wonder. I know you're supposed to stop and make sure this, that, and the other thing, but I didn't because there were a lot of traffic going on. But so it was unavoidable. Now, but when I get back, I'm worried that, you know, what if it wasn't a deer? You know, you have all kinds of things go through your mind. And so the sainted Mrs. Cross would get out of the car in Savage, and she says, "Don't worry, Paul, it's a deer." I said, "Well, how do you know?" She sniffs and says, "That's exactly what my dad's deer camp smells like. Smells just like that." So apparently their deer camp has a certain smell to it. Is that correct? I mean, when you're butchering a deer, it smells a certain way. And she could remember her dad, you know, butchering deer and so forth and so on. In the front yard, was it? Yeah, in the front yard, by the tire swing. They'd take the tire swing down and hang the deer up there. So, fact. In any case, it stinks. And so you have an altar for nothing but incense. Because here you are doing, really, this is what they're doing. And I mean, if you were just trying to descriptively give a picture of what's going on in there, you're butchering animals. That's the primary activity of what's going on in the tabernacle. I mean, there are other activities that are going on there, but you're butchering animals, and that stinks. And so you have this altar made for doing nothing but burning incense all the time so that it doesn't stink. It just smells like, if I'm picking on hippies today, you know, it smells like patchouli or whatever. You know, I guess not enough flower children out there, so it would help to have. My brothers used to wear patchouli. I never did. So then you have those things. And then last but not least, you've got the bronze basin because things get messy and you need to wash up. And there is a bronze basin for washing up. So there are the accoutrements, the furnishings of the temple right there, or the tabernacle. So there you have them. Now, let's take a look at them. Here is this is an artist's rendering from your ESV Study Bible, copyright 2008. That's a picture of what the Ark of the Covenant might look like. You'll notice that it's all shiny because it's got gold on it. Now, what's unusual about it? What's crazy? Pardon? Poles to carry. Well, lots of this stuff has the poles to carry. That's kind of a neat little feature. So you can put because, you know, even a small amount of gold is heavy. So you've got a feature so that you can put four guys on that and carry that rascal away make it pretty mobile. Okay, that's one interesting feature. What else about this that's interesting? The figurines on top, which are called what? Cherubim. Cherub and cherubim means plural. Anytime you see I am on a word in the Old Testament, cherubim means plural. There's more than one. Now, the problem is this. There are a couple things. Those are lions with wings, with kind of Egyptian-looking headdress. That's one particular interpretation. Other ones you'll see oxen with wings, and instead of Egyptian headdress, they'll have an Assyrian guy with a long beard like this, kind of like that guy on The Voice. What's his name? You guys not watch The Voice? There's a guy with a braided beard. I mean, it's kind of a cool-looking beard right there. Sundance. Sundance head. There you go. He's got a beard that would make ZZ Top jealous. I mean, this is a serious set of whiskers right here. I want to get a beard like that and braid it. You know, I'm shaking head over here. But nevertheless, this Assyrian beard with an Assyrian crown, but with the winged oxen. Is anybody bothered by this? Let's go through the 10 now. Number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Number two, not take the... Do what? No graven images. I do not have an answer for this, friends. I do not have an answer for this. So don't ask me what the answer is. But for some reason, this graven image is okay. And I don't know why. I can't tell you. I've never heard a satisfactory reason, because not only are they going to make these graven images on top of the Ark of the Covenant, but they're going to decorate the curtains with embroidery of these particular images. As to why this is okay, I don't know. The first place that we saw a cherubim was in the Garden of Eden. They are guarding the path so that you can't go back in there. All right? Again, please don't ask me as to what it means and why it's okay, because I don't know. This is one of the great mysteries of the Bible to me that I have not figured out yet. I guess it was a mystery. I couldn't figure it out anyway if I wanted to. But nevertheless, there it is. But they are, this is the place where once a year, the Day of Atonement, this is the Holy of Holies, and right up there is kind of the place where God meets man, so to speak. That's what the Ark of the Covenant is. Any questions about the Ark of the Covenant? That, you know, that would be a likely scenario. That would be that they're guarding what's inside it. That's correct. That would be a likely extension, because there is this sense from, and I hate to say this, I mean, they're in pagan culture, there are cherubim all over the place. I mean, there are. I'm not going to try and tell you otherwise. And yes, that they would be acting in a powerful manner, in a guarding manner. That would be a very good assumption there. Yes. Well, okay, just you see the top part of it, that top part that looks like a lid, that's called the mercy seat, or the bema. Some people call it the bema, that's the Hebrew for it. It's the mercy seat. You'll find that in, I think it's in Romans or one of those New Testament books that talks about the mercy seat, and that Christ is now that place, that now Christ is the place where God meets man, okay? But that's, yes, that's called the mercy seat. Doesn't look like a seat either, but that's what it's called, yeah. Yes.
So doesn't it seem that, of course, there are two ways to number the commandments.
Two ways to number the commandments, yep.
And so if you take the Lutheran...
If you take the Lutheran... So you're saying we have proto-ancient Lutherans and this is going to be okay.
Well, the admonition to not make graven images...
Admonition to not make graven...
...an explanation of the first commandment...
Okay.
...that says not to have any other gods.
Okay, the first... Brother Prester is suggesting that these may not be representations of God, so therefore they are exempt from the graven image rule. I'm not so sure. I'm not buying it, but that's okay. Nice try. It's good. It's as good as any explanation that I have heard, but I'm still not buying it, because, as I said, they would have been readily recognized by people living in that time as being utilized by other cultures. So they would have said, I've seen those before. So maybe it scares off other cultures. That's perhaps the case, too. I don't know. But nevertheless, there it is. And it will ultimately have other stuff in it, like the Aaron's rod will bud. It will have the tablets. It will have the golden mice and the golden hemorrhoids. I'm not making that up. Read the King James Bible and see what it says. The Living Bible. The Let's Victorianize It Bible, so we don't have to deal with unpleasantries. This is the table of the bread of presence. You will look that it looks very similar. You've got the same design there and motif. Again, this is one artist rendering of it. But you got a pretty good idea about the size of it. There's got some stacks of bread on there. Probably pretty tasty. No wonder David wanted those stacks of bread right there. And again, you got the spiffy golden rings to tote the thing around through the poles. So that's a pretty looking thing. The next one right there. Here is your menorah. Now, the interesting thing is that these resembled parts of... you'll see the word almond and pomegranate and other types of flowers. They resemble certain things of plants which were indigenous to that part of the world. So here's one. This one looks particularly like this. Now, this is a fascinating thing. In Rome, if any of you ever go to Rome, you should go to Titus's Arch. Titus's Arch. It's an arch built in the first century. It's a victory arch, and Titus was the general that went through and defeated the Jews in the rebellion of 70 AD. And on the arch, it shows all the stuff that they're carrying off as booty from that, and there's a picture of that on the arch. Now, it got to Rome, but where it went from Rome, we don't know. Isn't that fascinating? That's wild. Now, I'm suspecting it's not that one. I'm suspecting it's the one that they made after the Babylonians took that one off to Babylon. But it is interesting that there's a picture of one being carted off to Rome. So, from the first century. Okay, then we have, here's the bronze altar. You notice it's got this grate down below for getting all the stuff out of the bottom. And so you could just kind of, all the ashes and stuff will fall through right there. Okay, we're clear on that? Okay, then there's the altar of incense. Now notice these spiffy little horns right there. One of the things that you'll, if you ever do go to the Holy Land and you do see some ancient altars, they do have those crazy looking little things on the edges of altars there. That's a common feature, and those are called the horns of the altar. And it's particularly interesting because when, who is the guy? Not Solomon, Solomon's brother. Not Absalom, the other guy. What is his name? I can't think of his name right now. He wanted to be king in his place, and he goes in and he hangs onto the horns of the altar and says, "Don't kill me." And so he's hanging onto the horns. Well, that's what he's hanging on to right there. So anyway, pardon? Adonijah, that's the guy. Yeah, absolutely. Now, with regard to the that was all the stuff that's inside. Now, with regard to the tabernacle itself, the tent proper. This is where it gets incredibly detailed, and so we won't read this. I will just describe what's being described here for you. Number one, the first thing that's being described are the panels. There are certain panels that are being described in the tent proper. There is a tent inside a compound area, and then they've got these walls of curtains up there. So if you're into rugs, this is the place to be looking. But each panel is about yai by yai. I don't know how yai by yai is. I mean, yai by yai is yai by yai. But you can't. There's a fence ordinance. Isn't there a fence ordinance, Fargo? You could only have a 8-foot fence. Is that right? Can't have an 8-foot one fence. I think you can only have it. But I mean, this is one you can't see over. It's kind of like that. And these are woven panels. And if they're with regard to the inside of the tabernacle, they got these cherubs woven into them, embroidered right in, and it's made out of purple and gold and purple, red, and blue, and then gold and silver sort of stuff woven right on in. And you got these cherub kind of inside the pictures there. Okay, so you got that. And then they're held up by acacia wood. Acacia seems to be the wood of the day, but the acacia plant is kind of interesting. As I mentioned to you 2 weeks ago, it has a funny name in Hebrew, which I won't repeat again because otherwise you'll just think I'm acting like a junior high boy, which is really kind of, I'm channeling my inner junior high boy, as most of you know. But in any case, it is in fact what you'd likely find there. It's not necessarily what you want for lumber. I mean, it's not necessarily the best piece of lumber that you could find out there. There are many other things that are indigenous to Israel that would make for much better lumber. But it's the kind of lumber that you would find in that part of Africa, that part of the Sinai, so that adds some authenticity to it. So everything here that's wood is made out of acacia, okay? And again, if you've ever seen that TV show on PBS called Nature and that sort of crazy-looking tree on the front, their logo, that's an acacia tree. Okay? All right. So it's got that, but it also has something else. You'll recall that I pointed out that he's got these tanned ram skins, right? It's got goat skins and tanned ram skins. What it is that over top of this, there is this leather covering over top of the tent. Now, as to exactly what it's made out of is an interesting discussion. Because you'll read, if you're a reader of other English translations, you'll read all kinds of crazy things that are here. Some people say that it's made out of badger skins. Now, there were indeed rock badgers there. But perhaps the strangest thing that you'll read there is that it's made out of porpoise skins. Now, the reality is this. The Hebrew word that is used here, toxis, is in fact a word for an aquatic mammal. And so you figure, so they're in the Sinai Desert. Where are they going to get all these skins for these aquatic mammals? There are, in fact, porpoise in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba and the Gulf of Aden. They're porpoise there. It's kind of a curious thing. And some people say that they're red. Whatever it is, it's unusual. It's not necessarily something you would make your tent out of. The other stuff you'd make your tent out of, this is highly unusual regardless of what it is. But it covers the whole tent, all right? There's a lot of it, too. I mean, you'd have to go around killing. I mean, you'd have to kill a lot of tuna to get that many porpoises. I'm sorry. I'm easily amused. All right. Then there are the curtains of the courtyard. You see, there are two types of people. There are the people that can go into the tabernacle, and then the people that can only go into the courtyard. And you got to be able to determine who you are. Oh, actually, it's at this time only the high priest can go actually into the Holy of Holies, because the tabernacle itself, the tent proper, has two sections. It's got an outer section and it's got the Holy of Holies. That's where the Ark of the Covenant is contained. So, got that? That's your tabernacle. It's just a tent, and it's a blue-looking tent made out of fabric. The fabric's likely made out of goat yarn that's been dyed purple, blue, and red. Okay? Now, don't ask me if it's a purple state or a red state or a blue state, but as I said, all the colors are there. Any questions about the tabernacle?
When I think of a tent.
When you think of a tent.
A shelter over.
Yes.
All of the artist's renderings I've seen.
Square. It's open and square. Well, there is a roof. No, there is a roof to the. There is a roof to. That's the leather.
Small, holy.
Yeah. No. There's a roof over. This leather is over the whole tabernacle itself. But the tabernacle's not really that big. Now, I'll show you in a second a picture here of. Yeah, let's get to the pictures. Why not? That might be helpful. Okay, here is a picture of the tabernacle tent. You'll notice this brown looking thing that is covering over top. There's kind of like several layers. There is a frame layer on the inside where all the poles are. There's a curtain that separates the Holy of Holies. And there you see the cherubim kind of woven in there. You see that? You got your bread of presence. You've got your incense altar. You've got your menorah there. All right. Now, on the outside, you've got a red-covered tent, fabric, but then that brown is the leather. Okay? That brown's the leather. Now, whether it's fine Corinthian leather, I don't know, but nevertheless.
Have you ever been in the Stav Church over in Moorhead?
Have I ever been in the Stav Church in Moorhead? I don't know if my employment depends upon this, saying yes to this.
Because maybe the size of that and how it's constructed on the inside, the small area on the back side, it resembles something.
Actually, Bob is commenting that the Stav Church over in Moorhead, it is made to look like a Norwegian church. It is in the United States, last time I checked. But in any case, he commented that there's some similarity to the inside. Actually, the truth of the matter is, there's lots of similarity. The reason why churches in a traditional way are laid out the way they are is because of this. It was not an accident that the carpet in this modern, inexpensive, wooden A-frame church with drywall on the inside and just carpet. It wasn't an accident that my predecessors designed the carpet that way. People do this intentionally to model after that. Yes. So. Okay, but there's your high priest standing outside looking all cool. We'll talk about him in a little bit. So, all right? Okay. Moving right along. Now here's what you're thinking about. You see this ginormous open area. Now, this is a ginormous open area, and those are kind of the scale. You can see that they've got the fence up to code there. It's not more than 8 feet tall, but and then you've got all the stuff hanging around and keeping it safe and from all harm. And the reason why we can make a depiction like this is because it tells us in excruciating detail the size of this. If you can figure out what a span is, if you can figure out what a cubit is, you can figure out how big this thing is. A span is about, well, it's about like that. Yeah, 9 inches, something like that. That's about what a span is. And a cubit is that, from there to there. That's a cubit. Typically about 18 inches. That's what a cubit is. If you can figure that out, that's what you got going for you. And that's how big this is. A lot of fabric right there. Okay, but guess what? Good news. They got goats. So they got lots of stuff to make the fabric out of. They're in good shape. All right. The next thing is the priestly raiment. The high priest gets a special set of duds. Now, it's been a long time, well, maybe not that long a time, but maybe 2 years since I had to wear my special set of duds. I don't wear my special set of duds here. But, you know, I prefer not to wear dresses myself, but that's just me, neither here nor there. But the priest gets a special set of duds. And the special set of duds is as follows. The first thing about the special set of duds is, whoops, come on. Okay, there's an ephod, whatever an ephod is. An ephod is kind of like a little tunic type thing without sleeves that sort of fits over top of something else. And on this ephod, there's some special stuff. Let's turn to chapter 28. And look at this, because this is kind of interesting here. And there's some stuff here that might prove to be of some interest to us. You got chapter 28, the 1st verse there.
Then bring near to you Aaron your brother and his sons with him,
yep,
from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab,
Abihu,
Eleazar, and Ithamar.
Ithamar.
And you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother,
yep,
for glory and for beauty. Mm. You shall speak to all the skillful, whom I have filled with the spirit of skill, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood.
Yes.
These are the garments that they shall make: a breast piece,
yes,
an ephod,
a robe,
a coat of checkerwork,
a turban,
and a sash. They shall make
six pieces in all. It's interesting that the whole armor of God, remember, the kingdom of God is like football. You'd be...
It's dumb to not play with a helmet.
Crazy to play without your helmet. And how many pieces are there in the whole armor of God?
Six.
I'm just curious. I don't know if there's a correlation, but read on.
They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons to serve me as priests. They shall receive gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen. Mm-hmm. And they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue and purple, and scarlet yarns, and of fine twined linen, skillfully worked. Mm-hmm. It shall have two shoulder pieces attached to its two edges,
so that
it may be joined together.
Joined together.
And the skillfully woven band on it shall be made like it, and be of one piece with it, of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen. You shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel. Six of their names on one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone in order of their birth. As a jeweler engraves signets, so shall you engrave the two stones with the names of the sons of Israel. You shall enclose them in settings of gold filigree, and you shall set two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of remembrance for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for remembrance. You shall make settings of gold filigree and two chains of pure gold twisted like cords, and you shall attach the corded chains to the settings. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment in the skilled work. In the style of an ephod you shall make it, of gold and blue and purple and scarlet yarns and fine twined linens you shall make it.
Sounds redundant, doesn't it?
It shall be square and doubled, a span, mm-hmm, its length and a span of its breadth.
Yep.
And you shall set
it 9 inches, 9 inches.
In four rows of stones.
Four rows of stones.
A roll of sardis, topaz.
This right here, the breastplate of righteousness.
Sardis, topaz, carbuncle shall be in the first row. And the second row, an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst.
Keep reading that. Hang on just a second.
And on the fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold filigree. And there shall be 12 stones with their names according to the names of the sons of Israel. They shall be like signets, each engraved with its name for the 12 tribes. You shall make for the breastpiece twisted chains like cords of pure gold. And you shall make for the breastpiece two rings of gold and put the two rings on the two edges of the breastpiece. And you shall put the two cords of gold and the two rings at the edges of the breastpiece. The two ends of the two cords you shall attach to the two settings of filigree, and so attach it in the front to the shoulder pieces of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them at the two ends of the breastpiece on its inside edge next to the ephod. And then you shall make two rings of gold and attach them in the front to the lower part of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod at its seams above the skillfully woven band of the ephod. And then they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue so that it may lie on a skillfully woven band of the ephod, so that the breastpiece shall not come loose from the ephod. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment on his heart when he goes into the holy place to bring them to regular remembrance before the Lord. And the breastpiece of judgment you shall put the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. Thus Aaron shall bear the judgment of the people of Israel on his heart before the Lord regularly. You shall make the robe of the ephod of olive blue, and it shall have an opening for the head in the middle of it, with its woven binding around the opening, like the opening in a garment, so that it may not tear. On its hem you shall make pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet yarns around its hem, with bells of gold between them, a golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate around the hem of the robe. And it shall be on Aaron when he ministers, and its sound shall be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord, and when he comes out, so that he does not die. You shall make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it, like the engraving of a signet, "Holy to the Lord," and you shall fasten it on the turban by the cord of blue, and it shall be on the front of the turban. It shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall bear any guilt from the holy things that the people of Israel consecrate as their holy gifts. It shall be regularly on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. You shall weave the coat in checker work of fine linen, and you shall make a turban of fine linen, and you shall make a sash embroidered with needlework. For Aaron's sons you shall make coats and sashes and caps. You shall make them for glory and beauty. And you shall put them on Aaron your brother and his sons with him, and shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them, that they may serve as priests. You shall make for them linen undergarments to cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs, and they shall be on Aaron and his sons when they go into the tent of meeting, or when they come near the altar to the minister in the holy place, lest they bear guilt and die. This shall be a statute forever for him and for his offspring after him.
Okay. Good job. That's a long passage. But you got to see the picture of the stuff, right? All right. So we've got the breastplate with all the fancy stuff. We've got also the robe. Okay, we need a robe. We also have the turban, and we have the coat, and we have, last but not least, the sash. So here's this guy all decked out, blue, purple, red, gold, and stuff, and all this stuff across the front. Now, this stuff across the front has got some interest to me. This breastplate of righteousness. First of all, there are two things up top. There are two stones up top, and they're called the Urim and the Thummim. And the Urim and the Thummim are the seer stones. And did you ever know how to deal with a particularly thorny issue in church? How do we deal with a particularly thorny issue in church? We vote, right? We vote on particularly thorny issues in church. Do you know how they dealt with particularly thorny issues? They threw dice. That's what the Urim and Thummim are. Urim begins with the letter Aleph, and Thummim begins with the letter Tav. That's the A and T, but A and T are the first and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So it's the completeness of God's counsel. The priest takes off, there's a thorny issue, takes off the dice off his breastplate and rolls it, and it comes up 7. No, whatever it comes up, whether it comes up Urim or Thummim, that determines what the issue is going to be. Okay, so we've got that. Exactly. It's sort of like going out at midfield. Yes, it's just like that, exactly. There's even the referee that explains which side's which. No, but that's what that is. But then there are these 12 stones. Now, these 12 stones present a little bit of a challenge for us. Because if you were to take a look at them over history, it would be some of them are anachronistic. And a lot of times people don't know exactly what they are. But I've got a special deal for you. Here's my special deal. Here's what the priestly thing, this is one representation of the whole outfit looks like right there with the spiffy turban and the gold that says Holy to the Lord on it engraved in the top. And there's the two things on either shoulder, and there's the breastplate, and there's the ephod and all this stuff, and the bells that sort of warn God that I'm coming in, here I am. That's what the bells do. It's sort of like, the belling the cat. You know, if the cat has a bell on it, the mice know when the cat's coming, so there you go. But here's the cool stuff. These is some pictures of the stones on the priestly breastplate. There are 20-some names that have been given or possibilities for these stones. First of all, amber. Now, amber is there's a nice piece of amber. It's got a nice yellow color to it, but it really isn't a stone per se. I mean, what amber is sort of petrified resin. It's pine resin that's been, so you had to have seen Jurassic Park. That's where they get all the DNA from, because the poor little ants that are trapped in there and the mosquitoes that had sucked on dinosaur DNA, that's how they get it, for crying out loud. But again, that's what it looks like right there. A next one is called agate. You've probably seen agate before, but agate is a possibility there. It's got a variegated color to it. It's got little layers and so forth. Amethyst. Amethyst gets its name from right here. It's the transliteration of the Greek term here, and that's what it's called, amethyst. That's where it gets its name from. It's purple. Then beryl is another green, kind of a bright green color right there. That's one thing that it could be. Then carbuncle, my favorite name of any of these. Carbuncle, it beats what the Greeks called this stuff. You know what the Greeks called it? Anthrax. Well, you know what anthrax is? Anthracite, it's coal. And carbuncle, carbon, it's a Latin word versus a Greek word for it. But anthracite, or this isn't, but it was carbuncle is, this also means something else to people in. And then carnelian and cornelian, depending upon, it's got a bright orange color to it. Then chrysolite has a greenish tinge to it. Then crystal, some people use the word crystal in one of these to describe it. Crystal is just kind of quartz. Then diamond, that'd be kind of, here's where the problem is. What are they doing to these stones? They're engraving them. I want to see you do that. I want to see you do that in this time period. Emerald, okay, nice green color again. Garnet, kind of a purplish red. Green feldspar is another greenish color. Hematite or hermatite. That's supposed to be hematite. Sorry, little typo there. My fault. Hyacinth right there, nice orange color again. Jade. Jasper. Lapis lazuli. Isn't that a beautiful blue color right there? That's a beautiful. But notice how variegated it is. Moonstone, some people use the word moonstone. Onyx, people have seen onyx. I remember my high school ring was an onyx, black. Pale green peridot, kind of a opaquish color right there. Sapphire. Now, one thing we know for sure, we know it really wasn't sapphire. The reason why is that sapphires, as we know them today, the Hebrew word is sapphire, by the way. We think it was something blue, and we just called the other thing sapphire, because sapphires were unknown in this part of the world at that time. But it was certainly probably blue, possibly lapis lazuli. Ceridius, there's one for you. I'd like to say that five times really fast, but it's green, I know that. And then quartz, also grayish. Ruby, topaz, and turquoise. Now, I want you to see pictures of these things because some of them are clear, some of them are opaque, and some of them are variegated. We really don't know for certain. Well, we might know that maybe five or six of them are absolutely this particular mineral. But one theory is this, is that there were four different colors, and that there was a clear stone for each color, there was an opaque stone for each color, and a variegated stone for each color. So that's kind of one theory behind this. But it's hard to get it to do that. What's interesting is this. Any Revelation fans here? We will see this again. The same words in Greek, though, are the words of the colors of the walls of the New Jerusalem, interestingly enough. The 12, yes.
So the 12 stones.
12 stones. Yeah, exactly. Yes, of the New Jerusalem. Well, now you've hit on something. Where did they get these precious gems taken from all parts of the world? My brother, who happens to be a geologist, I've put him on this task. I sent him an email. He and I don't talk Bible very much. Matter of fact, hardly ever at all do we talk Bible. But I've put him on the task of giving me the because he knows the history of mineralogy, when certain gems were discovered, when they were named, things like that. So I've given the list of all the 22 different names there, and he's going to come back with me and tell me what regions of the world they come from and when were they discovered or when were they in common use. So this is a little project that we're doing.
There's a big mine in Arizona.
Yes.
At the base of the four peaks.
Yes. There you go. Getting it to Sinai Peninsula in 15th century BC would be a piece of work, though. That would be a challenge. But yes. But it's other places, too.
Sure.
There are other places. Like diamonds. I mean, we got a diamond mine in Arkansas, for crying out loud. It's a state park. Didn't you know that? There's a state park that you can go pan for diamonds. And some people get some big ones every now and then. Seriously, it's a park in Arkansas that has diamonds there. How crazy is that? And you thought you had to go all the way to South Africa and get past the barbed wire and barking dogs. Pardon? Goes gold, lots of gold in South Dakota, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, there's a little picture of that. As I said, I just wanted you to get a feel for what this looked like. But that is what the priest he worshiped. Yes, ma'am, Vicki. What's the significance? A very good question. The significance is this, and that's a great question. Is it, because it's called the breastplate of righteousness, is it a remembrance so that when the priest goes in there to remind God of, because all the names are on the stones, of who his are? That's one interpretation. Or another interpretation is that the priest is taking the nation of Israel into the Holy of Holies. That's another interpretation. Yes, but all their names are on there. They do represent each of the 12 tribes. That's correct.
Is there a reason that one tribe is on the turquoise versus the other?
Okay, one of the interesting things is it doesn't say. So you asked the question, is there a reason why one name is on one stone, one on the other? There's a thing called Kabbalism. You might have heard it because lots of movie stars like following. It's Jewish Madonna, yes. Jewish mysticism. They would have an answer for you. It's not a right answer because nothing in the text suggests what this, what these. First of all, what the stones. It says the Hebrews' names, but it doesn't also say which name goes with which stone. You assume that you take it across the top and go from first to youngest, oldest to youngest. That's an assumption, though. So we don't know which stone was assigned to which person. Yeah.
So then the significance would be that each of the tribes was associated as being precious or being...
That would be probably the best thing to say, that each of the tribes of Israel is assigned as being precious before God. Yes, that would be a good way of looking at this. Yes, absolutely.
How often do they go into the Holy of Holies?
Yeah. Once a year. We haven't gotten there yet. That's in Leviticus. Stay tuned.
Was there any? Did they actually tie a rope around their foot?
Nowhere in the Bible does it say that, but it is in other Jewish lore that they tied a rope around the. And that's in Numbers. The reason for that's in Numbers, and we'll get to that because our friends Nadab and Abihu. Well, their first trip in wasn't all that fun. Let's just say that. I take that back. That's not Numbers. That's Leviticus also. That's in Leviticus 10. We'll get to that before the Holy of Holies. Yes, Ernie.
Where was this thing built?
At
the base of the mountain of God?
Wherever you wanted it to be built. Where do you want this thing to go? Because that's what. Here's the thing. Wherever you have this fancy smoke, this pillar of cloud, right?
Right.
Okay. Then you've got this fancy pillar of fire, right? So the cloud is the daytime, so you can see it in the daytime, the fire so you can see it at night. Now, that cloud and that pillar of fire rest over top of the tabernacle. So when God wants to move, he lifts up the cloud, moves, and so you pack it all up and move it to the next spot. The whole thing. It's meant to be mobile. And furthermore, Ernie, there is some great detail telling how to move it. Yes, there is. There's detail on telling how to move this thing, which is kind of interesting in and itself.
Yeah, I thought it was just the tabernacle.
No. All the stuff and everything. And there are people that are specifically assigned to moving specific stuff. Okay? It's all, what does UPS say? Logistics. Okay? All right, so there we got this. So let's move on. The consumables. We'll just kind of go through them pretty quick. First of all, you've got lots of olive oil because what do you use olive oil for, right? The lamp. Olive oil is an amazing substance. It really is. I mean, they use it medicinally in the ancient Near East. They use it as food in the ancient Near East, and they also use it for light in the ancient Near East. It's an amazing product, so therefore you can see the value of olive trees. And olive presses are particularly valuable. So this is a highly, highly valuable commodity. So, but it does get consumed. So you need that. The next thing that you need that's consumable is the anointing oil and incense. Now you've got this special fragrance of anointing oil that's patent pending. That's actually not patent pending. It's patented. And that only the priests are supposed to use. It tells you how to make the stuff. Tells you exactly what proportions to use. But it's only supposed to be for this, and also how to burn the incense. That's an important thing to do as well. And then last but not least, if you're going to have sacrifices, you're going to need some willing victims. Well, maybe they're not so willing. Maybe they're just unaware victims. Let's just say that. You'll need some unaware victims, and they are the sheepsies and the goatsies and the oxenies and all that sort of stuff. The oxen, sheep, and goats are the ones that seem to get the nod for this over and over. Sometimes some other stuff too, grain offerings. But you're going to need stuff that gets consumed. So this is important to have as well. Okay, that's the consumables. Now, what's the purpose of all this? What's the purpose of all this? The first thing is this, as I mentioned earlier, the presence of God dwelling with his people, that you will find out, not only are you instructed on how this stuff's going to be put together and who's supposed to take it and who's supposed to move it, but also, you're going to get instructions on where you can park your trailer. Any RVers here? You get instructions on specifically where you park your trailer. And certain three tribes park to the north, three tribes park to the west, Three tribes parked to the south and three tribes parked to the east. Furthermore, Ernie, it's going to tell you how you're supposed to leave the trailer park, the RV park. It's going to tell you that those tribes on the east go first, those tribes on the south go next, and those tribes on the west go next, and those tribes go on the north go next. Now, it doesn't say this, but it makes sense. Because if you have enemies out there, they're likely going to be coming from the northeast. And also, you're also going to have enemies, the Egyptians, coming from the west. So you go out with the east first, then the south, then the west, and then last the north. So you're protecting yourself. It tells you exactly how to go out, too. It's fascinating in that regard. So, but the purpose is the tent's in the middle. The tent is in the middle. The next thing is that they bear the name of Israel in God's presence. That's the purpose. That they bear the name. This goes back to, you know, what is the purpose of this plate? And then last is the atonement of sin, to make a regulation of a right relationship between God and his people. Now, these are the three primary activities that go on in this tabernacle. And ostensibly, there are also the same activities, supposedly, that go on in the temple. But not so much, because this is, as I said, a mobile thing. When Israel is a mobile people, you can pick this up and move it on. Anytime that God says it's time to move on, well, here's how we do it. We know how to do this. We've had practice. Now, you might say to yourself, well, Paul, that's all well and good. But what practical purpose does it have in our lives? Come on, what's your favorite Christmas card verse? You know what it is. It's John 1:14. John 1:14 says this, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth." Actually, it doesn't say that. Do you know that it doesn't really say that? There are lots of words for dwell. Oikos was as a dwelling. There are lots of Greek words for dwell. Do you know what the Greek word here is in John 1:14? Eskene is the Greek word. It means, get this, to pitch his tent. And the Word became flesh and pitched his tent in the midst of us. That God takes on human flesh and pitches his tent in our midst. Anyone who was familiar with the Old Testament, reading that in the time of Jesus, would know exactly what the Holy Spirit was saying through John. That there is a replacement to the tabernacle. The next one is to bear the name of Israel in God's presence. What does Jesus do for us? Jesus is bearing the name of humanity by taking on human form in the presence of God. Emmanuel, God with us. You like that Christmas verse, too, don't you? I'm fresh out of Christmas verses for the next one. Sorry. But the relationship between God and his people, Jesus, of course, is the atonement of sin. So friends, really, what the tabernacle is, it's a precursor. It's a type. It's a preview of what God has in store for us. Not just one small group of people wandering in the desert, but for all people, that we might know the presence of God with us in our midst, right there in the center, that Jesus might represent us before God, and that we might know that we can have a right relationship before God in Christ Jesus. I think that's pretty cool. I don't know about you. I'm not in any hurry to rebuild tents or tabernacles or temples. I'm not in any hurry to rebuild them. You know why? I'll stick with Jesus. Pardon?
The second,
one the second what? Second tabernacle. Oh, let me put it, the history of the tabernacle. Okay, he asked, does it say, we don't know how many tabernacles they go through. The assumption is it wears out, and that's why, because it's made out of stuff. You know, leather's not going to last 1,500 years. I mean, certainly not in the elements. It's not going to last that long.
The last one
David built the temple. Actually, this is kind of crazy. Did Solomon build the temple or did David build a shrine? There's all sorts of questions somewhere along the line, the ark got separated from the tabernacle at the time of David. It was in a separate spot. Somewhere along the line, the ark got separated from the tabernacle, the tent. So we read that in 1 Samuel. Okay? So we don't know how that happened, but somewhere it did. Now, the temple gets built in Solomon's era, which is about 700 years after this, something like that, 900 BC, maybe 600-700 years, something like that. Okay? The ark is, some fun stuff happens to the ark. We haven't gotten there, but all kinds of fun things happen to the ark in 1 Samuel. If you want to have some fun and read the King James Version, because some people don't think it says hemorrhoids, read the King James Version there of 1 Samuel and like through chapter 6 and chapter 7, and then you'll see some of the fun stuff that happens to the ark. And also, even up to 2 Samuel 6, you see some curious things that are happening with the ark then too. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to make you read them because we're going to teach on it someday and I don't want to jump the gun. This was a plan of their salvation. This is God's plan all along. You see, this is why I dispute the notion that the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament are different. It's the same. Salvation is the same. It is having faith in God's anointed. Whether you're looking forward to that event or looking backward at that event, it's the same. And this is a picture of what that looks like for God's people. Okay? Jesus is our high priest. Read the book of Hebrews. If you really want to see all kinds of crazy connections between this and Jesus, read the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. That's got all kinds of crazy connections between this. Yes. Other comments? Well, thank you for being here tonight. And remember this old Chilton's manual right here. I'm surprised that there might even be points in there. You never know. Let's pray. Father in heaven, for Jesus' sake, thank you for the gift of your word and the gift of your tabernacle, which shows us the greater gift of your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. In the season of Christmas, teach us to be mindful of this precious gift that we have, that your dwelling is among us, that our presence is known before you, and that we are atoned for through your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Go in peace and serve the Lord.